So far, we have looked at 13 aphorisms of Friedrich Nietzsche's book, Beyond Good and Evil. Now, I'm going to be reading the 14th aphorism of the book, Beyond Good and Evil by Friedrich Nietzsche. 14. It is perhaps just dawning on 5 or 6 minds that natural philosophy is only a world exposition and world arrangement, according to us, if I may say so, and not a world explanation, but in so far as it is based on belief in the senses, it is regarded as more, and for a long time to come, must be regarded as more, namely, as an explanation. It has eyes and fingers of its own. It has ocular evidence and palpableness of its own. This operates fascinatingly, persuasively, and convincingly upon an age with fundamentally plebeian tastes. In fact, it follows instinctively the canon of truth of eternal popular sensualism. What is clear? What is explained? Only that which can be seen and felt. One must pursue every problem thus far. Obviously, however, the charm of the Platonic mode of thought, which was an aristocratic mode, consisted precisely in resistance to obvious sense evidence. Perhaps, among men who enjoyed even stronger and more fastidious senses than our contemporaries, but who knew how to find a higher triumph in remaining masters of them, and this by means of pale, cold, grey conceptional networks, which they threw over the motley whirl of the senses. The mob of the senses, as Plato said, aim is overcoming of the world and interpreting of the world in the manner of Plato. There was an enjoyment different from that from which the physicists of today differ from us. And likewise, the Darwinists and anti-teleologists among the physiological workers, with their principle of the smallest possible effort and the greatest possible blunder, where there is nothing more to see or to grasp, there is also nothing more for men to do. That is certainly an imperative different from the Platonic one, but it may notwithstanding be the right imperative for a hardy, laborious race of machinists and bridge builders of the future, who have nothing but rough work to perform. 15. To study physiology, what a clear conscience one must insist on the fact that the sense organs are not phenomena in the sense of the idealistic philosophy. As such, they certainly cannot be causes. Sensualism, therefore, at least has regulative hypothesis, if not as heuristic principle. What? And others say even that the external world is the work of our organs? But then our body, as a part of this external world, would be the work of our organs. But then our organs themselves would be the work of our organs. It seems to me that this is the complete reductio ad absurdum. If the conception causa sui is something fundamentally absurd, consequently the external world is not the work of our organs. 16. There are still harmless self-observers who believe that there are immediate certainties, for instance, I think, or as supposition of Schopenhauer puts it, I will, as though cognition here got hold of its object purely and simply as a thing in itself, without any falsification taking place, either on the part of the subject or the object. I would repeat it, however, 100 times, that immediate certainty, as well as absolute knowledge and the thing in itself, involve a contradictio in adjecto. We really ought to free ourselves from the misleading significance of words. The people on their part may think that cognition is knowing all about things, but the philosopher must say to himself, quote, when I analyze the process that is expressed in the sentence, I think I find a whole series of daring assertions, the argumentative proof of which would be difficult, perhaps impossible. For instance, that it is, I would think that there must necessarily be something that thinks. That thinking is an activity, an operation on the part of being who is thought of as a cause. That there is an ego, and finally, that it is already determined what is to be designated by thinking. That I know what thinking is. For if I had aught decided myself what it is, by what standard could I say that which is just happening and not perhaps willing or feeling? In short, the assertion I think assumes that I compare my state at the present moment with other states of myself which I know. In order to determine what it is, on account of a retrospective connection with further knowledge, it has any rate no immediate certainty for me in place of the immediate certainty in which the people may believe in the special case. The philosopher thus finds a series of metaphysical questions presented to him, veritable conscience, questions of the intellect, to wit, quote, whence did I get the notion of thinking? Why do I believe in cause and effect? What gives me the right to speak of an ego as cause, and finally of an ego as cause of thought? He who ventures to answer his metaphysical questions at once by an appeal to a sort of intuitive perception, like the person who says, quote, I think and know that this at least is true, actual and certain, unquote, will encounter a smile and two notes of interrogation in a philosopher nowadays. Sir, the philosopher would perhaps give him to understand, it is improbable that you are not mistaken, but why should it be the truth? 17. With regard to the suppositions of logicians, I shall never tire of emphasizing a small, terse fact, which is unwillingly recognized by the credulous minds. Namely, a thought comes when it wishes, and not when I wish. So it is a perversion of the facts of the case to say that subject I is a condition of the predicate think. One thinks, but that is one is precisely the famous old ego. It is, to put it mildly, only a supposition, an assertion, and is assuredly not an immediate certainty. After all, one has even gone too far with this one thinks. Even though one contains an interpretation of the process and does not belong to the process itself, one infers here, according to the usual grammatical formula, to think is an activity. Every activity requires an agency that is active. Consequently, it was pretty much on the same lines that the older atomism sought, besides operating power, the material particle wherein it resides and out of which it operates, the atom. More rigorous minds, however, learned at last to get along without this earth residuum. And perhaps some day we shall accustom ourselves, even from the logician's point of view, to get along, the little one, to which the worldly old ego has refined itself. 18. It is certainly not the least charm of a theory that it is refutable. It is precisely thereby that it attracts the more subtle minds. It seems that the 100 times refuted theory of the, quote, free will, unquote, owes its persistence to this charm alone. Someone is always appearing who feels himself strong enough to refute it. 19. Philosophers are accustomed to speak of the will as though it were the best known thing in the world. Indeed, Schopenhauer has given us to understand that the will alone is really known to us, absolutely and completely known, without reduction or addition. But it again and again seems to me that in this case, Schopenhauer has only did what other philosophers are in the habit of doing. He seems to have adopted a popular prejudice and exaggerated it. Willing seems to me to be above all something complicated, something which is a unity only in name, and it has precisely in a name that popular prejudice lurks, which has got the mastery over the inadequate precautions of philosophers in all ages. So let us for once be more cautious. Let us be unphilosophical. Let us say but in all willing, but is firstly a plurality of sensations, namely the sensation of the condition away from which we go, the sensation of the condition towards which we go, the sensation of this from and towards itself, and then besides an accompanying muscular sensation, which even without our putting in motion arms and legs, commences its action by force of habit. Directly we will anything. Therefore, just as sensations, and indeed many kinds of sensations, are to be recognized as ingredients of the will, so in the second place, thinking is also to be recognized in every act of the will. There is a ruling thought, and let us not imagine it possible to sever this thought from the willing, as if the will would then remain over. In the third place, the will is not only a complex of sensation and thinking, but it above all is an emotion, and in fact, the emotion of the command. That which is termed freedom of the will is essentially the emotion of supremacy in respect to him who must obey. I am free. He must obey. This consciousness is inherent in every will, and equally, so the straining of the attention, the straight look which fixes itself exclusively on one thing, the unconditional judgment that this and nothing else is necessary now, the inward certainty that obedience will be rendered, the inward certainty that obedience will be the commander. A man who wills commands something within himself which renders obedience, or which he believes the strangest thing above the will. This affair so extremely complex, for which the people have only one name, inasmuch as in the given circumstances we are at the same time the commanding and the obeying parties, and as the obeying party we know the sensations of constraint, impulsion, pressure, resistance and motion, which usually commence immediately after the act of will, inasmuch as the other hand we are accustomed to disregard this duality and to deceive ourselves about it by means of the term I. A whole series of erroneous conclusions and consequently of false judgments about the will itself has become attached to the act of willing, to such a degree that he who wills believes firmly that willing suffices for action. Since in the majority of cases there has only been exercise of will when the effect of the command, consequently obedience and therefore action, was to be expected, the appearance has translated itself into the sentiment, as if there was a necessity of effect. In a word, he who wills believes with a fair amount of certainty that will and action are somehow one. He ascribes to success, the carrying out of the willing, to the will itself, and thereby enjoys an increase of the sensation of power which accompanies all success. Freedom of will, that is the expression for the complex state of delight of the person exercising volition, who commands and at the same time identifies himself with the executor of the order, who, as such, enjoys also the triumph over obstacles, but thinks within himself that it was really his own will that overcame them. In this way, the person exercising volition adds the feelings of delight of a successful executive instrument. The useful underwills or undersouls, indeed, our body is but a social structure composed of many souls. To his feelings of delight as a commander, Lefebvre said more, what happens here is what happens in every well-constructed and happy commonwealth, namely the governing class identifies itself with the success of the Commonwealth. In all willing, it is absolutely a question of commanding and obeying on the basis already set, a social structure composed of many souls on which account a philosopher should claim the right to include willing. As such, was in the shape of morals regarded as the doctrine of the relations of supremacy under which the phenomenon of life manifests itself. Stay tuned for the next podcast. Thank you for listening to the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche's English translation of Beyond Good and Evil. Cheers.